You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show here on this Thursday, January 5th, 2017. Mercy, still getting used to saying 2017. I haven't written a check yet, so you are allowed at least a couple of mulligans on that, I think, when you enter into a new year anyway. It's just hard to believe time keeps ticking away, and the older I get, the faster it seems to go. But that's just me. Anyway, welcome into the program today. Hope you had a good night's sleep. Hope you're up. If you're listening live, got the sleep out of your eyes and you're strapped in and buckled up for a good show today. Second hour, Father Alan Carter. It is a Thursday. We missed the last couple of Thursdays of 2016, so it'll be good to get back into a rhythm with Father Alan and First Cup Theology every Thursday morning. Father Alan, who's the pastor of Saints Peter and Paul Catholic Church, parish in the lovely little hamlet of Danville, Kentucky. Real small town America is Danville. But not tiny town, right? I mean, they've got a university there. It's beautiful. You almost feel like when you're in Danville, you're in the deep south. But Father Alan, sort of the country priest there at Saints Peter and Paul, he'll be on. We're going to talk about how Christianity is fundamentally about responding to a call. It's about vocation, that word that has its same etymological root as the word voice. It's hearing a call, and it's very appropriate for a couple of reasons. One, our topic, because one, Father Alan is the director of our vocations office in the local diocese here, the Diocese of Lexington, Kentucky, where I work in my full-time role. Father Alan, along with pastoring a parish, heads up the vocations office, and which primarily means, even though, yes, we all have a vocation. I mean, that's the whole essence of today's topic. We all have a call. We're all called forward by Christ to follow him, to know and experience his love, and to allow his love to transform us. We all have that capital V vocation. But within that capital V vocation, we have a lowercase v vocation, and that is the chosen path by which we live out our primary vocation. And where Father Alan primarily focuses is on the call to priesthood and religious life. But we'll talk to him about Christianity in the broader sense today, since he works in the area of vocation, and what it means about responding to a call. It's also an appropriate topic because of today's and yesterday's gospel reading, taken from the first chapter of St. John's Gospel, in which we see in today's Gospel, Jesus goes to Galilee and finds Philip. Philip says to him, "Follow me." Philip was from the town of Bethsaida, the town of Andrew and Peter. And Philip found Nathanael and told him. And so there's this contagious chain of call. But this phrase, "come and see," because Nathanael dismissively, when Philip tells him about Jesus from Nazareth, says, "Can anything good come from Nazareth?" Philip says to him, "Come and see," the exact same words in yesterday's gospel that Jesus used when calling him. So Christianity fundamentally answering a call. And so we'll talk to Father Alan about that in the second hour. Look forward to that conversation. We'll also talk about Catholicism and culture. You're going to have to keep indulging me on my references to the book Silence by Shusaku Endo, the Japanese Catholic who wrote this novel, haunting novel. It's ever since I read it the couple of days beginning with Christmas, it continues to ruminate around in my brain. Looking forward to seeing the film. Hopefully, when it comes in wide release, it will be here in the Lexington, Kentucky area. I saw a tweet yesterday from Timothy Stanley, the journalist from Great Britain who I have on the program periodically. He tweeted that the sobs you heard in the back of the theater at the end of the movie Silence were his. So with a recommendation like that, how can I not look forward to seeing the film? Again, about, if you haven't heard or not aware of it, about the great anti-Christian persecution in Japan and the Portuguese priests who find themselves there in Japan in search of getting confirmation that their mentor, Father Ferreira, has indeed turned from the faith under the threat of torture. So anyway, I look forward to that. We'll talk about Catholicism and culture, because that's a big theme in the book. How does the Christian faith mesh with culture? How do you distinguish missionary activity with cultural imperialism? So we'll get into that. We'll talk about why apologetics are overrated, and also some solid lessons from a TV priest, that TV priest being Father Francis Mulcahy from the old show MASH, if you remember that. If you want to be a part of the program today, anytime during the show, 573-4BREAD-4 is the number you can call or text, 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. I'm a little hungry this morning, looking forward to breakfast after the show. Going to go get my go-to Easy Play at McDonald's. I have a couple of friends we meet for breakfast every couple of months, and we're usually oriented around some sort of a sports prediction bet. And so my friends Jeff and Brian, we made bets way back at the beginning of the college football season. Brian's a big Michigan fan, Jeff an Iowa fan, I a long-suffering Kentucky football fan. We made our picks to see who did the best. We picked each all three teams game-by-game results, and I won that one, so I'll get a free breakfast. But then we made a little prediction bet about each, about 15 of the bowl games. And I think I came in second, Jeff came in first, and Brian and both came in last. So if I recall the stipulations of our bet, Jeff and I will both be eating free, which always tastes better. So if you happen to know Jeff and Brian, make sure you give Brian a hard time about his bad luck in picking games. Anyway, today, as I said, the feast day of St. John Neumann. I was, a year ago, September, I was in Philadelphia. St. John Neumann, the fourth bishop, or Newman, I'm not sure how you pronounce that. It's N-E-U-M-A-N-N. I've heard it both ways. St. John Neumann, the fourth bishop of Philadelphia. Interestingly enough, I was at a parish that is named for him there in Philadelphia. I was there on the occasion of Pope Francis' visit to the United States. I took a group from our local diocese, a large group, on pilgrimage there to the World Meeting of Families and to see Pope Francis. I'll never forget it. But when we were at that parish there in Philadelphia, there it's an interesting thing because, of course, you know, as Catholics, we certainly venerate relics of saints. It's actually something we get from our Jewish fathers in the faith. And sometimes that involves bodily parts, bones, organs. It really does take a certain sensibility, you know. So much of being Catholic at times just really rubs up against Protestant sensibilities, particularly Protestantism over the last few decades, which has become increasingly less like Catholicism. Luther, Calvin, some of those guys, the early reformers, they wouldn't have been freaked out by relics. But show a Protestant a jar with a saint's tongue in it. It's kind of like, you know, you wouldn't begin trying to share the Catholic faith with a devout evangelical Christian by showing him or her a statue of the infant Jesus of Prague, holding the little globe or holy hand grenade, as a friend of mine calls it, with different little, different little ponchos that he wears. You wouldn't start there. Anyway, I digress. I was at this church with dedicated to St. John Neumann, and there under the altar. Now, typically altars have some sort of a relic of a martyr. I don't know if this is still the case. It used to be, I think SOP, that there was a piece of a martyred Christian, either some relic of their clothing or perhaps even a bone, built into the altar where the holy sacrifice of the Mass is celebrated. Not sure if that's the case or not, but at St. John Neumann's parish there, they weren't messing around, because underneath the altar, with a clear glass front on the altar, was the entire body of St. John Neumann. Visible. While Mass is celebrated. Interesting. But just a little bit about St. John Neumann. He was, as I said, the fourth bishop of Philadelphia. Died at the age of 48. So again, keeping that pattern like we had yesterday with St. Elizabeth Ann Seton, of these saints who do such great things at ages younger than I am now, which is a bit sobering. But he was born in Bohemia, which is what we would call now the Czech Republic, and had a burning desire to be a priest. He was actually rejected from the priesthood because they had so many priests in Bohemia. Imagine that. I'm sure that's a different story today. And so he decided he wanted to go to the American missions. So he landed here in the United States in the early 1800s with a dollar in his pocket, extremely short. And they used to laugh at him the way he rode a horse, because his feet wouldn't reach the stirrups. And he gave himself with complete abandonment, answered the call to not only be a priest, part of the Redemptorist order, but then ultimately the fourth bishop of what is now the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. So St. John Neumann, we talked about yesterday, acts, different second and third acts in life. You never know what God's plan for you is. It's true for all of us. Our aim is simply to answer the call. We'll be back in just a minute with more. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Fifteen minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show on this January 5th, feast day of St. John Neumann, fourth bishop of Philadelphia, one of the first American saints, I believe. Anyway, my pleasure to be with you. If you want to learn more about Breadbox Media, just go to breadboxmedia.com. You'll learn more about this missional enterprise. That's really what we're about. It's about getting the good news of Jesus Christ and His love, the beauty and the richness of the church he founded upon St. Peter and the apostles, that continues on down through the centuries, and the mercy that is offered relentlessly for those of us who find ourselves stumbling along the way. God is in to transform us, oftentimes despite ourselves, and he's in for the entire job. So that's the good news indeed. Check it all out at breadboxmedia.com. You can listen to podcasts of your favorite shows. You can check out many of our contributors from coast to coast. Subscribe through Google Play, iTunes, or Podbean, or become a friend of your favorite show. Hint, hint, wink, wink. And through your monthly support, receive access to exclusive online content. My question of the day today is Robert Duvall's 86th birthday. Talk about your Hollywood, I wouldn't say Hollywood treasure, an American treasure. I think one of the great actors of his generation, no doubt. And so I'm asking the question is, what is your favorite Robert Duvall performance? There are a lot of different resources out there online, different top 10 lists and all the rest. And one I posted on the show's Facebook page has number 10, Open Range. I'm really glad Open Range made the list. It is one of my favorite Westerns. Certainly, I would say in my top 5 to 7 Westerns. I haven't thought it through, but his performance with Kevin Costner as a Boss Spearman, just fantastic. Number 9, True Confessions. Now, this is one I've not seen. Duvall and De Niro, in which they play brothers, Duval is a cop and De Niro a Catholic Monsignor. Number eight, the original MASH. I think I'd forgotten that Duval was in there. He played Frank Burns. This was in the film version of MASH, of course. Number seven, THX 1138, which is a movie a little bit before my time, 1971. I think I was five. But number six, Falling Down. Falling Down is a guilty pleasure with Michael Douglas as the maybe the original deplorable Trump voter, frustrated, American working man. Anyway, yeah, Duvall plays the police officer who's after him. Number five, the great Santini. This is how he got his first Academy Award nomination for Best Lead Actor in that role. Number four, Network, a film I've not seen. Number three, Apocalypse Now. Love the smell of napalm in the morning. Number two, Tender Mercies. Duvall's first Best Actor Oscar, actually the only one in his career so far for Tender Mercies. He played a country singer trying to recover from his alcohol addiction. And number one, of course, The Godfather Saga. So one I would love to see on there was A Civil Action. I don't know if you've ever seen that movie, but with John Travolta, Robert Duvall, play opposing attorneys in a civil suit related to pollution. It's really, really good. So anyway, I've gotten some comments on Facebook, which you're free to chime in through social media. Mike Allen Show, the handle through Facebook or Twitter, actually. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post a thought on Facebook or on Twitter. Tom and Skip both vote for Secondhand Lions. I forget who he's in that one with. He plays Haley Joel Osment and himself, and I think Michael Caine. Very popular film, I know. The Great Santini, Skip also says. Ephraim says there are two, Tom Hagen in The Godfather, and Wiley King in Something to Talk About. Yeah, that's the one with Gina Rowlands and Julia Roberts and Dennis Quaid, I believe. Megan says The Godfather. Ernie says so many good performances. Colonel Kilgore in Apocalypse Now. Also, Augustus McCrae in Lonesome Dove. Andy says The Apostle, hands down. Duvall should have won the Oscar. Tiffany, Apocalypse Now, and The Godfather, and Chris, so many great movies. A great overlooked movie is Tender Mercies. Yeah, so I love Robert Duvall. To me, his entry, his being listed on the cast of a film increases my likelihood to see it by about 500%. But that's just me. 573-4BREAD-4, you can chime in if you want. 573-4BREAD-4, you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Big news in college basketball, Grayson Allen's indefinite suspension at Duke lifted after one game. Of course, there's some Coach K typically immune to criticism, but he's taken a little bit on this one, some cynicism. I mean, here's a guy who three separate occasions now has tripped opposing players. And as an indefinite suspension lasts one game. He in the starting lineup actually last night for Duke's thrashing of the really awful Georgia Tech team. What's happened to that program? I mean, they went to a Final Four, what, about 10, 12 years ago? But I digress. Anyway, I guess the most logical explanation that I've heard, you know, Krzyzewski's getting ready to have back surgery, I believe, Friday. He'll be out for a month, and he wants this situation with Grayson Allen taken care of before he goes away so that his interim, Jeff Capel, doesn't have to deal with it. I get that, but and I think there's a point to be made, as his former player Jason Williams did, that the ACC should have levied a suspension. But it is amazing to me how people tend to bend over backwards to exonerate Coach K from any responsibility for this. I guess that's part of winning big, but anyway, I think it's a bit of a mark on his integrity, in my opinion. Other sports news, of course, there are now, I think, 6 NFL openings and a lot of speculation about what's going to happen with those NFL openings. And I think I saw one piece on these 6 openings that talked about who were the best fits and front runners for these 6 open NFL jobs. Wow, you pull up the article and Urban Meyer's face appears. You really think Urban Meyer would consider a jump to the NFL? I don't know. Anyway, you've got the Buffalo Bills, 1 of the 6. Let's see. You've got the Denver Broncos, of course. Now that Gary Kubiak has decided he needs a physical break, which you got to respect that, actually. Next, you've got the Jacksonville Jaguars, a program that has really struggled for some time now. The Rams could be an attractive position. They're in conversations, evidently, with Sean Payton. The San Diego Chargers. And lastly, the San Francisco 49ers. So we'll see how they play. The other NFL article I saw was speculating on a Super Bowl that you would love to hate, and that would be the potential of a Cowboys-Patriots Super Bowl. That would be a tough one, though I probably, because it's been so long since the Cowboys won a championship and I really don't like Brady and Belichick, I would probably cheer for the Cowboys in that one and then immediately take a shower afterward. Okay, let's move on to some What Were You Thinking nominees. Spanning the globe, as we do every day, with no shortage. I like this, go dumb or go home, as we like to say. San Diego bank robber reveals his identity by using his ATM card during a heist. I dub criminals, fish in a barrel, I know, but can't help myself. Alvin Lee Neal robbed a downtown San Diego bank, but before he did, he inserted his ATM debit card at the teller window, revealing his name and other personal information. You're robbing the bank, man. Is it really time to make a withdrawal? He was sentenced in federal court to 3 years and 10 months in prison. Evidently, he entered the Wells Fargo bank, approached a teller. He swiped his card through the card reader, and when the teller asked how he could be helped, Neal replied, "You're being robbed. Don't make a mistake." He then handed the teller a note that had a similar statement. When the teller hesitated, Neal said, "You don't want anyone to get hurt. Don't make a mistake." All I would say is, a physician, heal thyself. Second What Were You Thinking award goes to the guy, the New York man, who got arrested for DWI and then proceeded to, because he knew his face would be in the paper of the weekly upstate New York paper, he went and bought hundreds of copies of the publication in an unsuccessful effort to keep others from reading about his arrest. Yeah, I'm a big fan of the old Andy Griffith Show. It reminds me of the time Opie decided to self-publish a little neighborhood paper. And when it wasn't very interesting, Andy and Barney suggested he get more human interest stories. And he began to listen to town gossip. It printed in his paper, and Andy and Barney went out and Aunt B trying to scoop up those papers before they were read. This is what that sounds like to me. Unfortunately, Joseph Talbot, not so successful. And now his mugshot is actually online as well. I'll give you the winner when we come back from the break. It's always fun. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Redbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
We're right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show here on this January 5th. A pleasure to be with you. If you've got a comment or a question, 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Keep my 16-year-old son, Bruce, in your prayers, if you would. He's gets to have the fun colonoscopy this morning. We're concerned about perhaps Crohn's disease. Pray for him. He did not have a fun day yesterday. If anyone who's ever had one of those procedures knows the day before is the worst part. Don't expect that when you're 16. So keep him in your prayers, if you would. We appreciate it. Let's get back to our What Were You Thinking nominees for the day, because we've got one more yet to go. Blaise Pascal talked about the grandeur and misery of man. We oftentimes think of the grandeur, but here's some of the misery. The winner, whoever the social media person is for Wendy's. I'm a fan of Wendy's. You got nothing. Square hamburgers. Always taste fresh. I like Wendy's a lot. But whoever the social media person is, the name of the article here, Wendy's tweets Pepe the Frog meme. Fast food chain Wendy's on Wednesday tweeted a Pepe the Frog meme, but swiftly deleted it after outcry over the image's connection to white nationalist alt-right internet culture. The image shows the company's mascot and namesake, Wendy Thomas, morphed into the frog meme, which has been used online by members of the far right to demean and harass, often with anti-Semitic undertones, opponents of Donald Trump's candidacy. The Anti-Defamation League has called the meme a hate symbol, though its origins are with a popular and non-racist webcomic by illustrator Matt Fury. Here's the quote from the company, their official statement. Our community manager was unaware of the recent evolution of the Pepe meme's meaning, and this tweet was promptly deleted. Now listen, here's the thing. If you are involved in social media for an international corporation, shouldn't you be attuned to trends in social media and what things mean? Listen, I know nothing from nothing. I'm 50 years old. I have a slide phone, okay? But I knew that Pepe the Frog was a charged image politically. So how in the world somebody whose job it is, social media, did not know that? Unbelievable. You can see the tweet on the, I'll put a link to this on the show's Facebook page, before it was promptly deleted. I'm not even sure why. I mean, even you look at the image, what's the gain there? Anyway, so that's the winner. 573-4-BREAD-4. If you want to nominate a What Were You Thinking story, or if you want to share your own, because as I've said, we've all done dumb things. I probably have done more than my share of most. So anyway, 573-4-BREAD-4. Politically, we're sitting here, what now, 15 days away from the inauguration of Donald J. Trump. I remember last year during the probably early part of the year, before I really ever considered the possibility that Donald Trump was going to win the presidency of the United States. I was not alone. I mean, you can go back and read the stories about it. People didn't think he was ultimately going to be a serious candidate. Well, so much for that. Anyway, Donald Trump, and I remember at the time saying things like, the thought of Donald Trump giving a State of the Union or an inauguration speech is too bizarre to even conceptualize. Well, bizarre or not, it's going to happen January 20th. And then you're going to have, not long after that, the State of the Union address. I will say this, it will be interesting. As I noted in a previous show, I concur with Time Magazine in naming Donald Trump Person of the Year. Person of the Year is not necessarily an endorsement of a person, but a recognition of their significance in the world scene and in cultural affairs. And certainly Donald Trump the remarkable story of his winning presidential bid, particularly when just about everybody had written him off in the weeks leading up to the election. Truly, probably the most remarkable story from 2016. Now, we'll see. We'll see how he governs. We'll see how he comports himself as president of the United States. There are signs already during the transition that, you know, wherever you go, there you are. And Trump shows no intention of backing off of his tendency to use Twitter to shame his opponents and so forth. It is going to be a wild ride, that's for sure. So anyway, keep him in your prayers. Keep our country in your prayers. Keep outgoing President Obama in your prayers. Prayer is always a good thing. As St. Padre Pio liked to say, pray, hope, and no worry. Indeed. A couple of topics that I wanted to get to today. One was an interesting story that I actually just came across last night and then again this morning. The surprising, stunning story that Franklin Graham, son of Billy Graham, well-known conservative evangelical preacher, somebody who unabashedly endorsed Donald Trump for president, Franklin Graham, who is oftentimes quoted when you need a good story from what used to be called the religious right. Franklin Graham has announced that he has gone vegan. I think I first saw this tweeted from actually yesterday's show guest, Charlie Camosi. He posted this link to this story like, what? Now, just if you don't know what a vegan is, a vegan is somebody who not only gives up meat in their diet, but any sort of meat-related product. So anything dairy, for example, or butter or eggs, anything that is taken from animals, whether it's animal fats, any sort of product like that, the vegan eschews. Anyway, so Charlie Camosi tweeted this picture of Franklin Graham that he tweeted out. Day number 4 of my vegan diet. Red beans and rice, greens, and vegan roll for lunch. Hey, this isn't too bad. Charlie's text says, whoa, wait just a darn minute. What? Charlie, who is a well-known advocate for the humane treatment of animals. So here's the interesting thing, though, because I went to see Franklin Graham's tweet where he tweeted this picture. And according to some of the stories that I've read, the Reverend Graham is going vegan primarily because of health concerns that he has. I guess maybe he got some bad numbers from his physician and so forth, and he sees this as a way to sort of take charge of his personal physical health. But what was amazing to me when you go onto his Twitter page and you see this, the number of positive responses from people who probably ordinarily don't like Franklin Graham much at all. Because when you think about vegan people, you tend to think, if I were to guess, if you were to do a poll of vegans, my guess is that 90% of them, if not higher, tend to be politically liberal on a whole host of different issues. Most vegans motivated by and animated by a desire to not kill animals or not to even use animals and their byproducts. And so vegans are usually animated by a strong understanding of and belief in what we might call the animal rights movement. These are not the people who would find somebody like Franklin Graham, a very conservative evangelical, as somebody that they would affirm. And yet you can see the almost breathless excitement from those who tweet their positive view of his decision to go vegan. And what it's got me thinking about it, and my thoughts are a little informed here, so you may say, what else is new? But anyway, it's got me thinking about this whole relationship, which I've talked a little bit about before, and I know Charlie Camosi believes very strongly in this opportunity that we oftentimes neglect as to use the label pro-life, those who believe in the humanity of the unborn child from conception to natural death and believe that that unborn human child from the very moment of his or her conception has an inalienable right to life. We have missed an opportunity oftentimes to build bridges with those who are motivated by compassion over similar issues. There were a number of years ago, a writer who I like a lot, who wrote a piece in First Things, the Journal of Religion and Public Life, her name is Mary Eberstadt, about this potential bridge of mutual respect that could be there between pro-life people and pro-animal rights people. And that oftentimes, it is pro-life people who are most guilty of assaulting or burning the very bridge that could be built. We'll talk about this a little bit more when we get back from the break, because this whole Franklin Graham gone vegan thing has me thinking more about it. And as we think about the opportunity of persuasion in the pro-life cause, not simply a culture war mentality. We'll be back in just a minute. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show. Again, my question of the day on Robert Duvall's 86th birthday. What is your favorite Robert Duvall film? Brian posted to Facebook. He said The Natural, which I think he plays Roy Hobbs' manager, doesn't he? A reporter. Anyway, he lists that as his favorite Duvall film. If you want to chime in, 573-4BREAD-4, you can call or text. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. You can post a thought on Facebook or Twitter. As I said, I think my two favorites are Open Range, the Western that he's in with Kevin Costner. There's even a love interest in that, and Ed Benning, not Robert Duvall's, but Costner's. But even despite that, it's a good film. And then also A Civil Action, in which he plays the opposite attorney from John Travolta in a civil suit against a prominent company based on a true story. Really, really underrated film, which William H. Macy is outstanding in that as well. So if you want to chime in, would love to hear from you. Let's look back in history a little bit on this day, January 5th, over the ages. What are some other things that have happened? Let's see, 1780. Oh, sorry, that was yesterday. 1531. So would that be 485 years ago? I can do my math now. Pope Clemens VII forbade King Henry VIII to remarry. Of course, we know how that worked out. 1781, a British naval expedition led by Benedict Arnold burned Richmond, Virginia. In 1855, the birthday of King Camp Gillette, who, of course, would go on to patent the razor. 1914, Henry Ford, head of the Ford Motor Company, introduced a minimum wage scale of $5 per day. Let's see, in 1945, earlier we were talking about Pepe the Frog, the original Pepe, animated Pepe. Pepe Le Pew debuted in the Warner Brothers cartoon Odorable Kitty. 1946, Diane Keaton's birthday. She's 70 years old today. Really one of the great actresses, I think, of her generation as well. In 1949, on this day, in his State of the Union address, President Harry Truman labeled his domestic program the Fair Deal. All My Children, soap opera, premiered on this day in 1970. Happy birthday to Bradley Cooper. now 42 years old. 10 years ago today, Bill Cowher resigned as the head coach of the Pittsburgh Steelers. I guess when he said he was done with coaching, he really was done with coaching. I guess unless you've got unquenchable competitive blood in you, the gig of being a studio analyst, much better than that of being a head coach. You can actually sleep at night, not get much criticism. So a Cowher, I think, has found where he likes to be. And on this day, a very sad day, actually, 1988, Pete Maravich, American basketball player, died of heart failure at the age of 40. You know, I don't think I realized he was quite that young. I think he was playing a basketball game, a pickup basketball game. Talk about a guy who was somebody you would pay to watch, Pete Maravich. So anyway, those are some things that happened down through the ages. Back to this story about Franklin Graham, the well-known evangelical preacher, son of Billy Graham, of course. The social media abuzz with the reports that he has now adopted a vegan diet, giving up not only meat, but any sort of animal product. Graham says that he's doing it for the sake of his health. It's left much of social media in apoplexy because people tend to have their categorical boxes in which they place people. We all do it. We tend to assume that if a person believes X, then they also believe Y and so forth. And oftentimes, there's merit to those stereotypes. I mean, you can usually find, for example, you know, when you look at these sort of cultural inkblot tests, whether it's the shooting of Trayvon Martin, whether it's the killing of Eric Garner, whatever the circumstance may be, it doesn't even have to necessarily be a crime. Just some sort of things fall down in a certain predictable dichotomy. And so Franklin Graham, who is a conservative evangelical part of what used to be known as the religious right, usually seen as a polar opposite politically, somebody who would never consider being a vegan. People in Franklin Graham's group, it is assumed, not only would not become vegan, but would often openly mock vegans. Usually making appeals to biblical injunctions about how animals exist for our food and so forth. Sometimes even the joke of if God didn't want us to eat meat or if God wanted us to be vegetarians, why did he make animals out of meat and so forth? So it's fascinating to see the reaction on social media. It has provoked quite a reaction. A picture that he tweeted out eating red beans and rice, day four, he said, of my hashtag vegan diet. And getting approving tweets from fellow vegans, people who would not ordinarily support Franklin Graham. And as I said, it reminded me again of an article that Mary Eberstadt had written back in 2009 in the Journal of Religion and Public Life called First Things. The name of her article, you know it's a good article when it sticks with you for, what now, 8 years. Pro-animal, pro-life. Eberstadt writes this: why aren't vegetarians and pro-lifers more closely aligned? After all, the best writing about ethical vegetarianism, the moral case for refusing meat, as opposed to the more self-interested arguments from health or finance, is good enough to provoke serious reflection even among non-vegetarians. Yet while this increasingly thoughtful literature flourishes, reflecting the movement of many Americans, especially younger ones, into the varieties of a meat-free diet, it has also proved a one-way street. Vegans and vegetarians do talk to one another, but usually without anyone in the rest of the world talking back, especially those committed to defending human life, particularly the human life of the unborn. Eberstadt says one reason for the current estrangement between vegetarians and moral traditionalists start in the universities. Most academic thinking about vegetarianism and related dietary ethics today falls into two general pools of thought: utilitarianism and postmodern feminism. Both are hostile to the idea of admitting unborn human life to their circle of approved moral sympathy. As such, both have rendered themselves off limits to other serious people, those who draw their moral code from traditional Judeo-Christian thought, who might in different circumstances be open to persuasion. Now, I won't bore you by reading the entire piece, but essentially what Eberstadt does is that, and she in many ways bemoans the tendency of pro-life people to be dismissive of vegans and vegetarians, particularly dismissive if they are motivated primarily by a concern for animal welfare. Usually the pro-life response to people who are concerned about animal rights is, oh yeah, well, what about abortion? Or what about the, don't even talk to me about animal rights until you talk to me about the rights of the unborn. Now, believe me, I understand. I have responded in the past in the same way, but I question the wisdom of it now. Because as Eberstadt points out, here you have a group of people who were not pro-life, as we understand it, right? They are not concerned, it seems, about the unborn human person as we are. And yet perhaps they could be. Perhaps if an attempt was made to build bridges or to build a bridge built upon the common virtue of compassion for suffering, then perhaps there could be some progress made. But here's what happens. And this is one of the reasons I think that Charlie Camosi, who was my guest yesterday, wrote a book called something like Beyond the Culture Wars. And the problem with culture wars, so particularly on an issue like abortion, is that we tend to surround ourselves with like-minded people. We tend to make bold statements that are going to get us pats on the back from those who we respect. And all the while, getting sort of self-congratulatory pats on the back, but not persuading anybody, so that each group remains entrenched in their own particular camps. But persuasion is a different thing. And when you see, and maybe I'll post a link to this tweet from Franklin Graham, when you see the positive response, Franklin Graham, who tends to get a lot of negative responses, by the way, from particular segments of the culture. But the people who are negative toward him most often, now you're seeing them be positive toward Franklin Graham because they're seeing in him what they believe, no matter what reasons, motivations, even if his motivations are health-related, they see someone who they can talk to and who actually sees value in their point of view. And I think it's a starting point. I really do. We'll talk about this more in the next hour. How committed to the pro-life cause are you? Am I? Would we be willing to go vegetarian or vegan in order to build bridges? I think it's an important question. We'll be back with more. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
Listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.